Now, you've done a big part of your career lately talking about beer and studying beer and the American beer market. So if I want to have a conversation about the American beer market, where do I start? What's the beginning?
Well, the talk tonight is going to start from the beginning. We'll actually begin with the origins of beer, which actually are earlier than agriculture itself. So there is some anthropological evidence that that beer was in large part what encouraged folks to start growing crops. So starting with that and working all the way into kind of the modern era, where in the 80s we had fewer than 100 breweries in the United States. Today, we're sitting over 8,000. I believe we have another 3,000 breweries in planning. So there is a magical story going on in the resurgence of local, hyper-local craft beer. At the same time, the story of beer in general has been largely a story, at least in the 20th century, of consolidation. So today, about 30% of the world's beer comes from one company. So even though we see some really kind of exciting, novel local beers, it does not necessarily translate all the way to a change in the market. Craft beer only represents about 12% of the nation's beer consumption.
But that 30% number has stayed the same.
The number of breweries that control that 30% has consolidated significantly. So the most famous one being when AB InBev came together and Anheuser-Busch sold or was acquired by InBev. The next step that was also very famous was the merger of Miller Coors and AB InBev. So there have been a lot of conversations. There is also a large push with those breweries, those large subsidiaries, to acquire more craft breweries. So in the literature, we call it craft washing. For example, Blue Moon was never its own brewery. It's actually owned by Coors. So anytime you're buying Blue Moon, it's
always
a Coors product.
Always was.
Yep. Goose Island was acquired by Anheuser-Busch. Wicked Weed is another one that's an Anheuser-Busch beer. Even the breweries that we think of as craft are not formally defined that way. Founders Brewery, for example, makes fantastic beer, but according to the definition set forward by the Brewers Association, is not technically a craft brewery.
We have a lot of places that are making beer now.
Sure.
Do we have more than before?
Yeah, actually we do. The history of craft beer is such that we're almost repeating the model that we had before Prohibition, where in the last 20 or so years, one in six neighborhood bars have closed. And in their place, these hyper-local craft breweries have popped up, where you have growler pours and tap rooms that are usually the selling points, and brew pubs are obviously a large part of that. So selling food right alongside the beer. And that's very similar to what we had prior to Prohibition. If you look at the per capita number of breweries in the United States, in total in the United States, we're on pace with where we were in the 1800s. Now, that's not entirely true for the entire U.S. The number of breweries are largely consolidated in certain areas. So the southeastern United States, for example, doesn't have very many breweries per capita.
Well, Sunbury used to have a brewery. You know, you can still find bottles in an antique shop. There was a brewery in Northumberland. This is the late 1800s you're talking about, where there were breweries all over?
Yeah. So the late 1800s was this kind of exciting time for hyper-local beer. But as we developed throughout beer history or beer economic history, the Industrial Revolution allowed us to develop these supply chains that would create the ability for somebody in Pennsylvania to drink an Anheuser-Busch from Missouri. That did not happen prior to the 1800s. It couldn't happen because there just was no supply chain, no refrigeration, no ability to take a beer with glass bottles. Pasteurization hadn't been discovered yet. No, all of that changed as soon as we moved into the 20th century.
If we are going to talk about today's beer chain from Missouri to here, describe today's beer chain. Where is beer going? Where is it being made? Where is it going? And I guess we'll dwell on that 12% in a second, but tell me about this timeline for beer or supply line.
So today's a very exciting time for anybody who likes local beer, because we have this ability and this interest on the consumer side in hyper-local products. So one of the big projects that we're working on at Michigan State right now is understanding the role of terroir in beer. So the notion of terroir is usually discussed in the wine literature, where Merlot grapes taste different if you are growing it, that Merlot grape, in California versus if you're growing that Merlot grape in France, for example. Now, we're starting to explore whether or not beer tastes different if the hops are grown in Michigan versus Washington. So we've finally reached this very unique place in beer history where about every state in the U.S. now has some small number of acres of hops. Prior to the early 2000s, all of the hops, or most of the hops in the entire United States, were grown in the Pacific Northwest. And they still are. That's where most of the hops in the U.S. are coming from, the Pacific Northwest. But Michigan is now the fourth largest hop producing state in the country. And our hops taste fundamentally different than what they can grow there, just by nature of the growing climate in Michigan relative to the growing climate in Washington.
Okay, so your hops taste different. Do your beers taste different?
Yes, it comes right through. Yeah,
I would be here. I'm going to sit here and say all beers taste almost the same.
Well, that's an empirical question that I'm very excited to test. Actually, in the coming months, we're going to be running that exact experiment where we have one beer and we're going to infuse one of the beers with a Washington hop, and the same beer is going to be infused with a Michigan hop, and we'll see if people can taste the difference. The way that consumers taste things and choose things is not just a function of how that beer tastes, but also a function of the prices and the other available options when they purchase the beer. So one of the papers, or two of the papers actually, that I've published has explored this notion of choice overload. Right, so if we're going from less than 100 breweries in 1980 to more than 8,000, maybe 9,000 breweries now in 2020, how many breweries is too many breweries? You know, if every one of these breweries is making 10 beers, that is a lot of beers to keep track of. So what we decided to do is I talked to some friends at a wine bar in Oklahoma to see if they would double their number of beer options. Because who else would have choice overload more choosing a beer than wine drinkers in Oklahoma is the rationale. So we doubled the number of beers, and we could actually decrease the chance that you would choose or purchase a beer if I increase the number of beer options. So usually that's where the story would end, right? So some people get overwhelmed by a number of options that is too many, and they just decide not to buy anything at all. But the next thing we did is we started thinking like a seller. If that's true, then why has the average grocery store gone from having 8,000 choices in 1975 to 45,000 choices in 2014? Well, if I add on a special, or I provide some type of information like beer advocate scores, for example, or maybe I highlight the local beer, I can eliminate that choice overload problem. And you see that in breweries today, right? When you go into a brewery, they generally are going to highlight their, you know, top two beers or the award winners that they really try to market. And while they have other options for those more adventurous drinkers, there is those standard beers that people are more willing to go to if they're not familiar with the options.
So when I go into the beer, or I go into the grocery store and I go to the beer section and I look around, this is all part of a strategic marketing option availability experiment. So
at some level, it's amazing to see how grocery store beer sections look now versus even 10 years ago. But one of the more interesting pieces of that grocery store story is the number of beers that are in the craft section but are actually owned by one of the big brewers. So there's a paper that was published about 2 years ago where they went through all of the locations or all of the grocery stores in Lansing, Michigan, and they counted the number of four-pack or six-pack, consumer-facing four-packs or six-packs that were owned by a large brewer, that were a joint owned or a subsidiary owned, that weren't technically craft breweries. but we're in the craft section. And it's over 30% of the beers that you're seeing in that grocery store that say craft are technically not craft.
How do you know that?
So there's a very complicated web of ownership. And again, the way that you distinguish between a craft brewery and not a craft brewery is the ownership. So, for example, here in Pennsylvania, Yuengling counts as a craft brewery. I don't think folks really think about Yuengling that way, but Yuengling is a craft brewery by the definition of the Brewers Association, whereas Blue Moon, again, is not a craft brewery.
Okay. Now tell me about consumer behavior. I hate to be so broad, but what are we using to make our choices? What's helping us decide? Is it just situational, like the sales you mentioned? Give me a quick overview of consumer behavior, you know, what we're buying.
So this is what I spend a lot of my time thinking about. In a world where agriculture and food has become so hyper-diversified, it's not good enough to just make cheese or just make beer. Now you have to make Munster or Pepper Jack, or you have to make a pale ale or a stout. And so every consumer now has the opportunity to choose what they like, and it varies significantly as to what they like and don't like. So historically, there was a fear from regulators that putting the alcohol content on a beer can was going to create some type of strength wars where all the breweries would compete against one another to make the strongest beer. But what we see in the consumer data is it's not always true that consumers only want the highest alcohol content beer. Some consumers actually want lower alcohol content beer. And we're starting to see offerings across the country and across the world, for that matter, that are lower alcohol content and sometimes no alcohol content. There are restaurants in Europe now that sell themselves as an alcohol-free bar. So we're kind of experiencing this resurgence in interest and energy around nutrition content in beer products. If you'll notice, a lot of the conversations around Miller Lite and Coors Light, et cetera, are about calorie content now. That didn't happen 10 years ago. We're also seeing people far more interested in how the beer was produced. So where were the hops grown? Is this organic or not? And that's not necessarily all of the beer consumers. It's clearly a very narrow niche subset of consumers. But that interest really wasn't even on the radar 10 years ago, 20 years ago. So I think we're seeing a movement toward consumers drinking better but drinking less.
Is advertising the linchpin to choices here, or are people developing? I mean, you could go to a grocery store and find 100 beers that you've never heard of. There's never been any advertising for it.
So we published a paper in Managerial and Decision Economics a few years back where we looked at how perceptions of taste and perceptions of familiarity influence a person's choice between beers. And what we found was that there is a subset of people who are more likely to purchase a beer if they are less familiar with the beer. So if they're unfamiliar with the beer, they actually like it more, and they're more likely to pick it. We also found that those people, they might say they're unfamiliar with the beer, but because they're unfamiliar with it, they also think it probably tastes great. So once upon a time, you would think about beer as being something of an experience good, where you would basically see something, and if you hadn't had it, you would assume it's terrible. There is at least a subset of the population now that sees a new beer and gets really excited about it. Taste ultimately is king. You know, once you have that first beer, that doesn't necessarily going to mean you're going to order it again. And as we've seen in the craft beer world, we've seen record numbers of closings every year for the last few years, in part because there are certain breweries that tried and just could not create a consistent barrel. Consistency and quality is still hyper important in growth in the craft beer market.
So in other words, each vat that they're doing has to taste pretty much the same as the previous one?
That's the dream. I've heard some operations management professors discuss how Budweiser is the best beer in the world because no matter where you are in the world, you can buy a Budweiser and you know exactly what that Budweiser is going to taste like. Doesn't matter where it was brewed, when it was brewed, how it was brewed, it's going to taste the same. And from an operations management perspective, that is remarkable. For anybody who's ever home brewed, good luck trying to make two pale ale batches the same. And those are 5-gallon drums. But we're talking about the largest brewery in the world, and they can make the same beer every single time. That's incredible. And so at some level, craft breweries are striving towards that consistency. But we are seeing this kind of new wrinkle where they're celebrating the inconsistency. They're celebrating the idea that every time you come in, it's a different beer. That's kind of neat. That's also a unique marketing strategy, but it doesn't sell to everybody.
What about my harsh observation that all beer tastes the same?
Well, like I said, that's an empirical question that I think about quite often. I don't think that's true necessarily. You would be shocked at the number of cultivars of hops that you have to choose from as a brewer. You would be shocked at the grades of malting barley that you have to choose from. The way that you brew a beer is always going to change the way that it tastes. I can guarantee you that a sour beer, if I put a sour beer in front of you and an IPA in front of you, you could tell the difference. Now, one thing to keep in mind, though, is that we live in this era when we're celebrating uniqueness of flavors. Not that long ago, you had things like the German beer purity law that constrained the number of ingredients that you could have to hops, water, and barley. They didn't have yeast because they didn't know yeast existed when they wrote the law. But those three ingredients were all you could use. Now, so I'm from Michigan, or I live in Michigan, and we're the largest tart cherry producing state in the country. I just toured a tart cherry farm the other day who is selling tart cherry concentrate to 500 breweries across the country for creek-style sour cherry beers. That is an exciting revelation in the way that we can taste a bunch of different types of products.
So do you ever go down to the local bar and order a beer?
All the time. Yeah, we've got a neighborhood bar that was built. It's the oldest restaurant in Lansing, and it's still got the original bar in it. And they have my pint waiting on me before I even sit down.
If people want to start a brewery, or if they want to start selling craft beer, what are the economics in the U.S. today? Is that a pretty good venture? Are the regulations overbearing?
Well, the regulations would shock you. We published a paper in Agribusiness a few years ago where we used machine learning to count the number of federal restrictions that it takes to get a beer from the hop yard to the six-pack. And this is just federal. This isn't state and local. But the number came in at about 94,000 direct and indirect regulations on this beer value chain.
Some of which related to transportation, some of which related to weighs and scales, some of which related to sales taxes just on transaction, any transaction.
To pesticide use, so if you count all of those up and you assume that everybody's 99.9% compliant with rules, which probably not, but let's just assume that. Statistically speaking, you've never drank a perfectly legal beer. It's just not possible. So when you think about how those restrictions and regulations play out in one of these hyper-complicated, hyper-regulated marketplaces, it creates the opportunity in some places for a new brewery to kind of wade through the restrictions and regulations. So, for example, Dogfish Head, part of the reason, if you go read Sam Calagione's book, part of the reason he chose Delaware was because they didn't have any breweries yet because of the restrictions. But at the same time, you want to think about places, if you're going to open a brewery, that either have a lot of breweries and you're going to be capturing some of that agglomeration, or you're going to look for a place that has a large population with no brewery yet. Keep in mind that in the southeastern United States, it wasn't even legal to homebrew beer in Mississippi until 2013, to homebrew. So there are still plenty of places in the United States that have a large opportunity and a large drinking base that is looking for some type of good cold pint.
All right. Just about done. What should I ask? I haven't asked really the most fascinating thing that you've come across throughout all this beer study. What's that?
So the reason that I really got into beer economics is because it shows so much about the rest of food and agriculture. So I think studying this marketplace tells you so much about how so many other marketplaces are playing out. I mentioned cheese already, but any consumer product now is experiencing this massive disruption in the way that consumers buy things. I mean, all it takes is a Google search of what products are millennials killing. And I mean, there's so many products that millennials are supposedly killing. But if you read through the article on millennials killing the frozen turkey or whatever, what you're actually seeing is that millennials just don't want the standard anymore. They want to be able to have options. You know, the change in consumer tastes and preferences is toward this diversification in the grocery store. And that's an exciting proposition for not just beer, but for everything. And as we move into a world where we have this opportunity to create products that are specifically, uniquely local, you know, it opens the door for threats to an Applebee's model where every Applebee's tastes the same. But it creates maybe this hearkening back to the authenticity of the 19th century when you had your own local beer every town you went in. And that's cool.
Yeah, we have a brewery that's going in about a block from my house, so I'll be able to walk to it as soon as they get open. There's bars two blocks away, but this will be a brewery.
That's the dream.
So you can walk home. I live across from the cop station, though, so I can't stumble in too badly.
Yeah.
So that would be a dilemma. So if young people are reviving an agriculture-related retail aspects of the injury, is it safe to say the boomers just about killed us?
Well, say yes for our audience.
You know, it's not just young people that are drinking craft beer. It's not just young people that are excited about this this kind of push for localness. I think there are. So I'm a member of the Lansing Historical Society, and folks are always posting photographs of 1950, and you remember when we had this retail outlet downtown, and you remember when blank. There is this this resurgence, especially in these kind of older towns that had once upon a time a vibrant downtown area district, and now the breweries are moving in, and there's this resurgence of excitement in the downtown districts, in large part because of the brewery relationships that are being developed. And so it's not clear that it's just about the beer anymore. It's more about the community. And I think that that's something that boomers can get behind just like young people can.